Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Centennial Lecture Series. This afternoon's lecture is entitled, Why Institutions Matter. Today also marks the seventh lecture in the year-long Centennial Lecture Series that features renowned international and local personalities in the academe, government, and industry. Please rise for the Philippine National Anthem. At this point, to give us a special message for this afternoon's lecture, please welcome UP President Emerlinda Roman.
Good afternoon, dear colleagues, friends, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. It is a Saturday, a non-working day for some of us, but perhaps it is just as well, because then you are free and available to listen to the lecture of a person, an individual who has distinguished himself in his field. Before I proceed to talk about our guest this afternoon, allow me to share with you a few things about our centennial celebration. I believe many of you already know that the university is celebrating its 100th year this year. Among the many activities that we have lined up to commemorate our founding, we consider as the centerpiece of our UP Centennial celebration, the UP Centennial Lecture Series. And you will pardon me for being repetitive. I have said this a number of times, but I would like to explain again what the lecture series is all about. Two categories of the series have to do with UP itself. 12 of our colleagues will deliver lectures and direct our look backward to the path we have traveled thus far. They will also direct our look forward to the road not yet taken. They will help us assess our own record and suggest directions for the future. They will present the view from inside the University of the Philippines. The distinguished individuals from outside UP will offer us their ideas about what UP signifies for the rest of the country and how we can best continue to serve it. They will present the view from outside. The other two categories range farther afield. In keeping with our role as the national university, and therefore an important source of ideas that will not just advance knowledge, but will guide policy, experts both from UP and from other institutions will explore pressing issues confronting the nation and the world today. Issues like poverty alleviation, global warming, the state of Philippine education, the state of Philippine health, indigenous people, status of women, peace and conflict resolution, etc. Finally, distinguished persons who are not just experts but visionaries and whose life works have merited the world's recognition and respect will share their insights on issues in their respective fields. Under this category, we have had two distinguished lecturers, 2004 Nobel Laureate for Physics, Dr. Jonathan David Gross, and 2007 Harvard Foundation Scientist of the Year, our very own, a UP alumnus, Dr. Baldomero Olivera. Today, we have the honor of welcoming the third of these distinguished individuals, another Nobel Prize winner, this time from the social sciences. Economic historian and 1993 Nobel Laureate in Economic Sciences, Professor Douglas North. Professor North, with his colleagues, permanently changed the face of economics by creating the field of new institutional economics. But I shall defer to our next speaker, who will formally introduce Professor North to explain a bit more about what we can expect to hear from our guest this afternoon. Professor North, you do us a great honor by accepting our invitation to be part of the Centennial Lecture Series. Your willingness to share your thoughts with us is proof of a generosity of spirit, which is perhaps an even greater gift than a great mind. On behalf of UP, I thank you most warmly for this, and I take a deep pleasure in inviting you, in welcoming you to the University of the Philippines. Thank you.
To introduce this afternoon's distinguished lecturer, we have invited another distinguished economist and faculty member at the George Mason University, protege of our distinguished lecturer this afternoon, and despite his height and accent, was born and raised in this country. May I call on Professor John Nye.
President Roman, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great honor and a distinct pleasure to be standing here today in the land of my birth to introduce a man whose writings are of supreme importance for the problems that face this area of the world today. As a recipient of the 1993 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Science, North stands as one of the giants of the economic profession. Yet, even that understates his importance to the social sciences. Perhaps more than the leading giants in the field, North's work is not only relevant to the Philippines, but especially important to policy and development. His wide-ranging appeal is seen not simply in the huge citations to his work by economists, but rare among distinguished economists, North is almost as widely cited in political science, history, law, sociology, and anthropology as he is in economics itself. Others, many of the great economists, are brilliant but highly technical, working on abstruse issues that are deeply important but perhaps less immediately relevant to the concerns of a developing economy. North's vita is so long that I don't think we would have time to be listening to me, or even time to sleep, if I went through it. However, let me mention very briefly that he spent most of his career at two institutions, That is, after receiving his bachelor's, master's, and PhD at University of California, Berkeley, he was employed for 33 years at the University of Washington in Seattle, where he became department chairman. And in 1983, he moved to Washington University in St. Louis. Great confusion for everybody, since it's both Washington, where I had the pleasure of working with him for 22 years. North's work has focused on a very simple question. In our view, the only question that economists should really care about. Why are some nations rich, others poor? In the 1970s, North broke with the conventional wisdom that said that the primary issue was lack of technology and lack of capital. But North argued that these were merely proximate causes of development, and the true problems were deeper and more fundamental. In North's views, the importance of high transaction costs and poor institutions were what really made the difference in terms of explaining which nations succeeded and which nations had failed. For instance, transaction costs can be thought of as the cost of making the exchange itself. In many cases, for instance, our statistics might treat, say, 100 pesos for a certain amount of fruit as being the same, regardless of where you bought it. However, it takes you an hour to buy fruit from one store and 5 minutes for the other. You all know well in the Philippines that the true cost of buying the fruit is definitely not the same. Yet economics and economists did not have a framework for thinking about how transactions costs, and particularly the high transactions costs, crippled an economy. Similarly, institutions, which North defines as the rules of the game, are all about, in his view, having the proper benchmarks, having the proper baselines for enabling things like productivity and technology. In particular, the rule of law, secure, stable, and easily tradable property, private property, stable policy, and low costs of trade are critical for sustainable growth. It is possible to grow without many of these. Indeed, no country today probably completely meets these conditions. But without them, sustained growth is difficult. Just as no man is 100% healthy, no nation has 100% of these characteristics. However, all we know is that at some point, a sufficient number of ills may strangle a promising nation or even bring down a successful one, just as a succession of small ills or composite health problems may completely cripple what was otherwise a sane or whole person. North's views on institutions are now conventional wisdom, but not then. It took 20 or 30 years for this to change. Moreover, we still do not fully grasp his central insight, the problem of the credible state. Adam Smith alerted us to the importance of the idea that mutual exchange, when voluntary, is beneficial. But you must have law, order, and stability in order for the exchange to be voluntary. Usually, this is guaranteed by a third party, which we think of as the state. However, as North was the first to emphasize in the literature, any state powerful enough to protect private property and ensure law and order is also powerful enough to abuse it. Hence, the issue is not whether to have a large state or a small state, but a state that does the right things to enable the market and growth and abstains from the things that destroy voluntary transactions. In most of human history, leaders and kings have been faced by the problem that we can say for short is the problem of make or take. For most of the world's leaders, for most of the world's nations, it is easier for the state or for the elites to encourage redistribution, whether for the sake of special interests, cronies, or for raw populism, than promote competition and production. As North will tell you, no one, least of all academics, likes competition. Hence, the great successes have been the nations that generally promoted order while mostly allowing economic competition to flourish. Even the great welfare states are mostly free economies, and modern bureaucracies have mostly arisen after substantial development occurred. In contrast, many of the poorer nations often saw the opposite. Bureaucratic growth, and transfers without the preconditions of initial economic growth. But what are we to do then? North's work encourages us to focus on the structure of incentives. Neither idealism nor cynicism will serve us. Most discussions of the economy in the popular press veer between a search for virtue or a crude descent into spending more money. But the search for the virtuous politician is a misguided one. What we want are not angels, but constrained rulers. The tendency of a frustrated people to hope for the election of saints on high will always mean more failure or frustration. We need to remember that some of the most well-intentioned rules have often led to the worst corruption. The point is to push the rules so they are as neutral and fair as possible and cause people to focus more on better production and making money, not just lobbying for it. Nord's latest work is a sobering examination of how difficult it is for nations to emerge out of what he calls the natural state. However, by causing us to focus on strategies that may be more limited and realistic, we might enjoy more success and less disappointment in the future. Ladies and gentlemen, I present my colleague and friend, Douglas North.
President Roman, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here in the Philippines. John has been trying to get me to get here forever, and I kept saying I'm going to come, and now I'm very glad I have come. It's a wonderful place, and I'm delighted to be with you. John gave such a good introduction, I'm not sure I couldn't just sit down, but I think I better do more than that. But he does pose a problem that is what I want to focus on. And that is, why do we have a problem? Why aren't all world countries rich? As economists, we know a great deal about the sources of what makes countries rich. It's productivity increase. And productivity increase means you get more output per unit of input. You'll pardon the jargon of an economist for a minute. And we know a lot about the sources of productivity increase. We also know the kind of institutions, when put in place, that tend to produce that result. Secure property rights, a judicial system that works, low-cost transacting, which John mentioned. All those are straightforward. If we know all that, what's the problem? How come countries that want to be rich are poor? And that's the subject of my talk, really. Now, it is about institutions, so I'm not deviating from what the title of my program says. It's just I'm going to focus it particularly on a specific aspect of institutions, and the most important one, which is how they affect the performance of an economy over time. Now, if we know all that, what is missing? What's missing is how to get there. It's one thing to know about what makes for economic growth. It's another thing, how do you create the conditions that will produce that result? And that's turned out to be very complicated for reasons I hope to elucidate in the next half an hour or so. Now, to give you an idea of how difficult it is, the World Bank, which I've been an advisor to for the last 10 or 12 years, has spent more than $100 billion on economic development. And as my friend Mary Shirley over there will testify, who has been a participant in World Bank for many, many years. It's done a lot of good things, but when it tried to evaluate and ask itself, how much have we contributed to improving economic growth, They had to shake their head and said, we can't seem to see much evidence that we've done much. And that's peculiar. It seems obvious that it should be very simple and straightforward. Well, there's a number of things missing. Beliefs, time, culture, institutions. I'm going to talk about each one because you've got to sneak up on this in order to get there. Why beliefs? Because the way we understand the world around us turns out to be terribly complicated. And in fact, our mind and brains are perhaps the most complex things that exist anywhere, any place, any time. The brain may weigh only 3.5 pounds, but operating, it produces, takes the senses, what we get from our eyes, ears, nose, and feelings, and in our brain constructs an explanation of what we're seeing, hearing, and so forth. Now that construction obviously is going to change with different environments, with different experiences, and those will produce different belief systems. So the first thing, therefore, is to recognize that the beliefs people have are a function of the experiences that they've had, and those experiences will vary with different environments, different cultures, different civilizations. Why is time important? Well, time's important because the way in which we understand the world is evolving through time. John and I are economic historians, and one of the things that we have long since recognized is the dynamic process of change that's going on through time means what happens in time one and what happens in time two, you've got to explain how you got from one to the other. And that's not simple, and indeed economics tend to ignore it. Now the reason why it's important is, and I'll say this very carefully, you don't know where you are until you know where you've been. And the reason why that's so is because the cumulative beliefs and institutions that are the product of the past constrain the choice set in the present. Now, I've used a technical economic jargon. You want to ignore economic jargon. But in this case, it's useful because what you want to know is how do you see the world? You don't learn everything. You've accumulated from the past a set of institutions and beliefs that shape the way you understand the present. And that indeed is what culture is. Culture is the set of beliefs and institutions that you've inherited from the past that shape the way you see the present and the way you shape the future. And therefore, it's very important to understand where you've been to know where you are. Institutions. Institutions, as John said, are the way we structure human interaction. That is, they define how we interact with each other and they define the way the game is played. They're made up of formal rules, laws, things like that, done usually by governments. Informal norms of behavior, codes of conduct, things that shape informally how we deal with each other, which in many respects are much more important than the formal rules. How I deal with all of you here or individuals in classes or whatever are all a structure that has evolved so that we know how to deal with each other effectively. And so informal norms of behavior not only shape the way we do things, but build into it a lot of the things that make for reducing the cost of transacting, to use a term that John used. Because to the degree that we have developed norms to trust each other, to rely on each other, to be interdependent, we lower the costs of human interaction in ways that turns out to be terribly important to economic activity. Institution of formal rules, informal norms, and enforcement. Now, without enforcement, institutions don't make any difference because if in fact there was no enforcement, people can ignore what the rules of the game are and act accordingly. And obviously, that makes it so that you would have the institution not make a difference. So enforcement is always there. It's either by laws that stipulate punishments for people who don't obey the laws, or by norms of behavior such as the fact that if we violate agreed upon codes of conduct, other people will not deal with us, whatever. But let me illustrate with my standard story. Professional sports. I'm going to talk about American football, but that's a little different than your football here, but it'll apply the same way. Football is determined and is shaped by the rules of how you're supposed to play the game, by informal norms such as you're not supposed to try to injure the players on the opposing team, and by referees and umpires who see that you don't. Now, I know that this doesn't happen in the Philippines, where you're much nicer than we are in the United States. But in the United States, in professional football, the Oakland Raiders used to always get to the Super Bowl, or not always, but often enough, by breaking the quarterback's leg on the opposing team. That's not cricket. Another game. And indeed, the result is that all games are played by a degree to which the rules and norms and enforcement define the way the game is played. And if you have, for example, strict enforcement, you have clear observation by umpires of violations and punishments that are deterrents, then you'll come closer to obeying to rules that apply. Where you don't have such things, then in fact, anything goes. Now, the reason why this is important is because that's the way societies work. They don't work the way they were intended. No society works exactly like it was intended. The further degree that they are from the intentions is a reflection of the degree to which informal norms and rules are not obeyed or have characteristics that don't encourage people to be creative, productive, and so on. So institutions are the keys to our understanding the performance of any society. They are the incentive system of a society. They provide the framework that determines how people will and should behave, and therefore the incentive system guides and really